recording is now mounted on the website, and I listened to it all the way through, and there was some faintness to it, and I was advised that the faintness was due to my using a headset. So I have the phone jammed against my ear during this conference, and hopefully the sound quality will be better.
Well, we're hearing you loud and clear.
Oh, that's good. And also, I figured out, like I say, how to get it onto the website so you can download it, so you can fast forward if there's a section that you missed or want to repeat.
That's great.
Filed. Hello?
Hi, Jan.
Yes?
This is Harry and Marshall.
Hello there, Harry. We were waiting just a moment or two for people to jump on board. So let me do this. Let me go ahead and start. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give the recording a formality to begin with. And then what I'd like to do is go around and have people introduce themselves and where they're calling from. And again, like last time, if you have any particular questions, I'd love to hear them now if you have them. But I'm also willing to hear questions at any time during this discussion. And then we'll stop at the one-hour mark and shift over, hopefully have more interactive than just me talking. So this is a recording made on August 2nd, 2008, and it's a teleconference about the pathwork materials, and we'll be working with Chapter 5 from The Path to the Real Self, Constructive Attitudes and Self-Confrontation, and also with the concept of collusion. And in just a moment or two, I'll introduce that a little bit further. So for the moment, why don't we go around and introduce ourselves. I'm Jan Rigsby. And who else is on?
This is Harry. I'm going to try to put you on speaker.
Help. Harry?
Yeah.
Hit *6. And that will mute, okay? Press *6, and that will mute your phone. And then when you want to speak, you're going to have to hit *6 again, okay? All right, so we'll presume that means he's muted. So, Harry, when you want to introduce yourself, you're going to have to hit *6 to turn yourself back on and then off again. So for the moment, why doesn't somebody else speak up first, and then we'll get to Harry in a second.
Hi, this is Lisa, and I'm from Austin.
Welcome, Lisa. You may be
Hi, this is Karina.
Sorry, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Karina, and I'm from Victoria in Australia.
Hi, I'm Tom, and I'm from Adelaide, South Australia.
Hi, I'm Janet. I'm from Houston, Texas.
This is Lila.
I'm from Singapore.
I'm sorry, Lila?
Lila from Denver, Colorado.
Any other person?
This is Harry from Marshall, Texas.
Welcome, Harry.
This is Wendy from New South Wales, Australia. I do have a question about how to do confrontation without being judgmental.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. We'll address that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else on the line? Okay.
This is Lila. Just as far as questions in reading the material for this particular conversation, the whole thing of collusion, and you know, I'm up to around a lecture 193, 194 at this point. I haven't read anything so far that I can recall that spoke specifically to collusion. So I thought it was kind of interesting, and questioned where this comes in the actual material. So.
Okay, I'm going to introduce that. I'm going to let you know why I did this. So, good question, and I've made a note. Thank you. Anyone else want to say anything?
Jan, this is Janet. I've got a bad connection, so I'm going to hang up and dial back in again.
Okay.
No worries. I'll let you know when I'm here.
Okay. So what I've done is I've disabled the chimes that tell us that people are leaving because that got awkward when people would go back on and off again. So we'll hear when somebody comes on, but not if they go offline. So let me answer, hopefully, these Lila's question in particular. What I thought was that PRS, I'm going to tell you what PRS means and go into that, but in terms of confrontation, one of the places where people have a lot of difficulty in Patchwork communities is that in the stages of commitment, in the second stage, there's a question, and presuming you've read through the stages, you know that there's a series of questions and a series of stages that is a public declaration of where you feel you are in your work. It is not a formal thing, and you can actually go back and forth in your stages, in your stage of commitment. But in stage two, in the last question, and this was written by the guide is suggesting that we forswear all forms of collusion and maligning against our Patchwork brothers and sisters and also against authority figures. So, Lila, you are absolutely correct. That is the only use of the word collusion in the entire 5,000 or 6,000 pages of lecture material. Interestingly, in Constructive Attitudes and Self-Confrontation, the guide says that attitude is everything, and attitude is the most common word found, other than the little tiny these and a's, in the Patchwork lectures. So the question, when people get to that question in the stages, part of they don't understand what the guide means by collusion. It hasn't been discussed. It's not the topic of a lecture. So it's an unusual situation. It comes up a lot in community. And it, as a concept, does relate to the Patchwork lectures. But not, you're right, the guide doesn't talk about it as a specific word. So I was going to go into that after the discussion of the PRS, but that's why I decided to do it, because when it does appear, it's a little bit out of the blue. And it's part of a so-called public ceremony, and it should be explored and related to before you get there. Does that help answer your question?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, because I hadn't seen anything, and so that's why I just said, where is this coming from?
Yeah. Well, very often in Patchwork communities, there are stages of commitment at least once a year. So people are witness to it or aware of it before they've read very much in the lectures. Mm. So you've got the opposite. You've read quite a bit in the lectures so that when you hear about it, you can put it all together. But it's even hard to explain sometimes because you can't actually quote a lecture or say, go read this paragraph and you'll understand what the guide means by collusion. So again, that's why I thought I'd go over it. In terms of the first part, the path to the real self, Path to the Real Self is a fascinating work. It's a little controversial. It was purported to be written by Ava rather than by the guide. However, if you read the preface to, it's an unpublished manuscript, so you have to get it from somebody, and we had ownership issues. The Patchwork actually didn't own it for a long time. So they now have ownership of it, and they'll be publishing it sometime probably next year. But in the preface, you can hear Ava's voice. You can hear the voice of a human being. And then chapter one is missing. And when you get to chapter two, it isn't Ava's voice anymore. It's the guide. And the rest of the Path to the Real Self, as far as I'm concerned, was written by the guide. It looks, feels, sounds exactly like the rest of the lecture material. What the Path to the Real Self does, to some degree, is it takes the 258 lectures and condenses them down into about 25 chapters or lectures. So the material is extremely dense. But what it does is it reweaves the concepts into a more dense fabric so that you get a stronger outline of the guide concepts. So I highly recommend if you can get a copy of the PRS that you do so. I can send out the chapter list and you can take a look at that. You can get the copy. You can get copies from Patchwork Centers, and I can talk to you individually about getting a hold of an individual chapter. But these chapters, they'll have a chapter on images, and there are 10 lectures on images in the Password Guide lectures. And yet this one really goes deeply into the concept, and when you read that after you've read the 10 lectures and you read the one chapter, it really gives you a strong sense of the whole concept of what's being discussed. So, yes.
Why is it taking all this time, all these years, for them to publish it?
Well, it belonged to John Parakas, not to the Password Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And when John Parakas died in 2002, his estate was thrown into probate, and there was debate about who owned what. So legally, nobody could publish it.
Right.
Now, why John did not publish it, I don't know.
Because I skimmed through it, and I found the same thing as what you said. It sounded exactly like Eva at the start. And then midway through, I said to Lisa, this is not, this is the guide. This is not Eva. But I said, it's a fantastic piece of work. And I'm thinking, why haven't they ever published this? it's really good.
Well, you can understand that within Password, this could create some controversy, where some people might say it was Eva, and some people say it's the guide.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult in nonprofit spiritual communities to do controversial things without there being a lot of consequences.
Yeah.
So for various reasons,
shame that it hadn't been released.
Yeah. So you have a copy because I gave it to you, and that's the way it's worked. Is people just give out their own personal copies, and it kind of cascades downwards.
But you said the Password Press will be publishing it next year?
Yes, they're going to put it into the new CD. They're going to republish the CD of all the lectures. And
okay.
They have been transcribing more and more of the question and answer sessions and the private group sessions that the guide gave.
Fantastic.
Wow.
So since the guide channeled through Eva from 1956 through 1979, they didn't park him on a shelf and bring him out every 2 weeks. You know, this boy's had other occasions to come forward.
Well, and it looks like, at least in the later years, I didn't notice it so much earlier on, but I'm noticing in the later years that it seems to take a break in May, and they don't start up again until September, and that's a huge gap, too.
Eva liked to go skiing in Europe.
Oh.
A very human organization. She liked to go skiing in Europe. She took the summer off.
Wow.
Okay. Even during that time period, however, she was the medium, and she could bring the guide forward. And the guide would come forward when Eva was doing private sessions with people. So this was an active spirit who did not need the temple of something to call it forward. She could call it forward at any time. And the guide originally began as automatic writing, and all the lectures are redone from the actual, this is a lot of history, but I'm presuming it's useful. Eva would go into a trance and present the lectures, and they would transcribe them, and then the guide would add to the lecture through automatic writing. So the written lectures are different from the spoken lecture. They are longer. And in the same way, my impression of the Path to the Real Self is not only that the guy did it, but that he was talking to a group while he did it. It's not even like it was only a written document.
Well, you know, like this, I think it was 192, where at the end it says, the tape ran out before we got all the questions.
Yeah.
So you're saying there was still some, was Eva the one that did the transcribing from the tape?
No. That particular tape, I remember that one. It's frustrating when you read that. Because the tape ran out during the question and answer period, the guide did not re-include that material as part of the automatic writing. So in other words, they would transcribe the lecture with all the questions and answers and then give it to Eva, and she would go into another trance, but in writing only. She would enlarge upon what she spoke during that time period. But because that was the question and answer portion, they didn't want to fake that. They didn't want to try to reconstruct that, I guess. So it's an awkward thing, but it was the most honest thing they could say, was they lost that portion, and it was an interactive portion. So the guy didn't make up for it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I had no idea. I just assumed that somebody tape recorded these sessions that she did, and then they just typed them up. I had no idea they went through that process, so that's very interesting.
Right, so they typed them up, and they gave them back, and she would change them, and they would take them back again.
Wow.
So, yes, and they actually reused some of the tapes originally. They didn't think that they were historical documents.
Oh.
They would reuse the tapes. I don't know when they stopped that.
Out of curiosity, has the guy come through anyone else?
Yeah, well, there's, what's his name? Donovan Sathanga has a couple things that he says he channeled the guide for.
Yes. So in answer to your question, there are people who believe that they have been in contact with the guide, but not to any significant level. Donovan has published a couple of papers. Relatively brief, no more than 20 or 30 pages, that he feels he was moved to write under the influence or spirit of the guide. But other than Donovan, nobody has made such a claim, and we have seen nothing that matches the style of the guide in people's writing. Does that help with your question, Tom?
Yes, thanks.
So that gives you an idea where the path to the real self comes from, and why the tone might be a little bit different, but as I said, I do not present it as the work of Ava. I present it as the work of the guide. So, starting on that. So, in terms of self-confrontation, when I put this out, I put it out in terms of loving confrontation, which one would presume would be outside with others, which is true. That's where we have the most trouble, is in confronting others. What the lecture says is that the first place to start with is yourself. That before you can give loving confrontation to others, it's important for you to be skilled and experienced at bringing such loving confrontation and constructive attitudes towards yourself. So I remember a commercial years and years ago where it was a breakfast cereal commercial, and there were three brothers. And they were all freckled and adorable. And the first two weren't sure of the cereal because it was supposed to be healthy. So they would shove the bowl towards their little brother and say, "Let Mikey try it." Okay? And that's the general attitude sometimes about, "Oh, this is a great idea. Here, you do it, and I'll see what it looks like." Okay? But in this case, I was taught in both my helpership and my core training that I was my first client. And if I couldn't heal myself and use the materials on myself, I probably wouldn't be able to use it for other people. And that's what this lecture is saying. Okay? That the first place to start with is yourself. And once you have developed healthy attitudes towards your own negativity, healthy attitudes towards your flaws and mistakes, then it is it's not only easy, you're giving other people the same benefit you've given yourself. And it changes the playing field. It changes the attitude of the confrontation. It changes the energy going in. So that instead of worrying about the confrontation process, what you're creating is an offering. And part of the attitude, of course, is that this offering may not be received by the other, which is sometimes true. So another aspect is, yes, it is very important to observe others. It is sometimes easier to see a concept in someone else, but we need to bring it back to ourselves. So 2 weeks ago when I was talking about reason, will, and emotion, I talked to somebody and they said that it had been very useful and that they were observing these factors, these styles, these tendencies in other people, and they were starting to get the idea. And that's wonderful, and we need to bring that in as well and see it inside ourselves. So the point of this is not to point out to somebody else what their style or type is or what they're doing, but to take in an attitude of love, to develop an attitude of love in ourselves. and then find out ways to share that with others. So if you're unable to face your own flaws and distortions, if you haven't practiced different ways of approaching your own attitudes and prejudices, if you haven't developed skills and techniques to support your own inner work, you're not going to be very adept at trying to deal with somebody else. I'll bring in another idea, and this comes from Lecture 180, The Spiritual Meaning of Relationship. And this is the phrase that everybody groans when they hear it. And that is that the more enlightened person in a relationship is responsible. And we groan because, number one, more responsibility, that's all we needed. But secondly, there's a tendency to say, what about the other person? When are they going to help? But the deeper meaning of that phrase is this. You cannot possibly expect someone who is blind to see. If you can see that they are blind, then you have a little bit more knowledge, a little bit more awareness, a little bit more consciousness about the situation, and you will naturally tend to lead in that situation. It's not that you have to. It's simply natural that the person who sees a larger perspective has a better opportunity to bring enlightenment into a situation. Same thing with confrontation. When we get down to the lecture itself, I commit sacrilege, and I boil the lectures down to 2 pages because a lot of the points are built on and discussed about, and it's hard to get the bullet points. I don't go as far as bullet points as a general rule, but I will boil it down to 2 pages. And inevitably, when I work with this lecture, at least a third of my 2 pages it winds up being daily review, because in this lecture, the guide most emphatically, and I think it does the best job of explaining why daily review is crucial, absolutely crucial, to any work, any inner work that you want to do. And so the same thing happened here. So in terms of the confrontation, I only wound up with a page and a third. And when I boil it down and then I go through it, what I find is that the guide's talking about attitude, and the guide talks about resistance, and then the guide talks about signals, how you find resistance, and then goes immediately into daily review. So that's the form. That's the form I'm going to follow going through this. If you have any questions, please jump in.
So if you could yeah. Mention something when we're going through it around moving through resistance, because I can often recognize my resistance, but actually getting through it, it seems like it's great. I don't seem to have a lot of control.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Happy to. The first thing that we need to buy into is that the first sentence in the short version that I prepared is that the discovery of destructive emotions, of faults one has ignored, is naturally upsetting. Nobody is happy to find out that they're a rude person. That just does not bring joy in and of itself. Okay? So your system, we have this little defensive system, and Lecture 101 on the defense is a wonderful, wonderful, brief, concise view of this. You've got a defensive system that you've built. And over the years, it has been built to protect you. And the last thing this system wants to hear is that it's flawed. Okay? The system is self-supporting, self-sustaining, and it has minimized its attitude towards certain things because it felt it had to have them. In other words, your system, your dynamic as a human being, may have felt that you needed to be aggressive to get through the day. And therefore, aggressive gets colored with a positive viewpoint. And passivity or weakness, for instance, I hate the P word, patience. I just start shaking whenever I hear it. It's a terrible word to me. Because patience means negative things to me. It doesn't mean the good parts. It means the bad parts. And so I have to work on myself on that. I have to work on patience, it's hard. but your system has taken a certain attitude towards hundreds of thousands of values and ways of doing things and style decisions, and it has woven them together to make you a successful human being. And by successful human being, I mean that you are all functional. You're not only functional, you're highly functional. I don't work with people who aren't already highly functional, because it takes that level of functioning to reach out for this spiritual work. Okay? So the discovery of destructive emotions, a fault one has ignored, is naturally upsetting. And that's the reason for the resistance. The resistance has a point of view. The resistance is basically trying to protect the system as it is. And anything you try to do to change it is seen as upsetting the apple cart. And your system just doesn't know what it would be like to be different. So the system, the ego, your defensive systems, the way your intellect works, your preference for reason, will, and emotion, all these things are part of your humanity, of who you are as a human being. And they were all set up to function together and smoothly, and decisions had to be made. So in these defensive systems, you've got feelings and emotions that don't fit. Everybody does. And in with these feelings and emotions that don't fit, there's a sense that if I let my rage out, it will hurt. So I will hurt someone. I will damage something. I will be punished. I will be my seniority in a group will be diminished. My authority will be diminished. Bad things can happen. Okay, but perceiving that they are there is different from acting them out. And we as adults need to get that. We need to get that we can control rage. That recognizing it and accessing it does not mean that we're going to display it. We're not going to be inappropriate. And there's a place in us that isn't certain about that. A child place where the last time we felt our rage, we did act it out, so we have a history of having acted out these things. And with our history, we're not sure where we are today. So we figured the best thing to do is don't go there. So that's how these feelings and emotions don't get worked on. They've been parked. They've been put away someplace because we don't know how to handle them. And because they've been parked and put away, they haven't been properly developed. They've atrophied, which means that when they come out, they're going to be, they're not going to suddenly become enlightened feelings and emotions. They're not going to be developed. They're not going to look good. So the best analogy I've been able to come up with is if you've got a 3-year-old who's throwing a tantrum and you put them in the closet and close the door, when you go back 10 years later and open the door, you're not going to find a self-actualized, developed human being. Okay? Well, feelings are like that, too. If you haven't experienced your rage, if you haven't seen it, if you haven't tasted it and felt it, if you're not familiar with it, if and when it does come out, you're probably not going to do a very good job with it. And that's going to add to your historical experience of, don't do that. It's bad. It never works. But if you can see that that's a very shallow interpretation of what's actually going on. We need to bring these feelings out, but we need to bring them out in safe places. Safe places such as work groups, self-led groups, in our journals. We need to bring them up for ourselves and not in the situations that trigger them precisely, which is why very often group work is so wonderful, because you can find your rage. And if you find it with your mother or your father or your brother-in-law, the triggering things could happen so quickly you just can't track them. You misbehave, you misspeak. And once again, you build another historical experience of, you see, that doesn't work. I can't handle my anger. But you can learn to handle your anger. And to learn to handle it, you're going to have to visit it. You're going to have to sit down and hold its hand and find out what that anger is all about. So that leads us to attitude. Let me say this one thing. The repression, reading from the lecture, the repression of childish, destructive feelings never eliminates them, nor their effect. Awareness does. Repression of childish, destructive feelings never eliminates them, nor their effect. Awareness does. And then the guide shifts into talking about attitude. And I'm going to tell you a little story about attitude. There used to be a little DOS program that searched the lectures. It was our first attempt at trying to get a search engine going. And it was a lovely one, and the people who still have it swear by it and won't use anything else. But it was awkward and clumsy. And it would find the word in the lectures, and it would then offer it as a paragraph to you. So if you typed in the word collusion, you would get the paragraph that the word collusion appeared in. So the context, of course, being critical to all this. So you would type in a word, and the little thing would just hum away, and then it would come back, and it would say, I found 23 references. Would you like to print them? And you'd say yes, and it would print them. It was lovely. A helper asked me one time, because she didn't have a program, if I would run a search on the word attitude. This is Allison, who taught in Australia, and she had suspected that attitude was everything. And she was curious how many times it was mentioned in the lectures. So I blithely go to my computer and type in the word search, and it comes back up, and I arrogantly don't read the number of how many times the damn word was mentioned, and I hit print and walk away. I come back, and the machine has printed 200 pages and is asking for more paper. Okay? So once you're in 200 pages, you might as well go. It printed about 350 pages of references to the word attitude. And I took that bundle of paper, and I gave it to my dear friend Allison, and I said, I think you have a point. Okay? That's what the guy, I've never seen a search of that, I've never seen anything of that magnitude, but of course I always read the number from that point forward before I hit print. I have never seen a search that brought up that many references. Attitude is everything. The guide is so emphatic in this lecture. Okay? So the first thing he says is it is never, never an outer event, such as, I love reading the lectures. They make you sound like you're stupid. Let me start over. It is never, never an outer event as such, responsible for happiness or unhappiness, no matter how much it may appear to be. In the last analysis, it is always the attitude to the event that determines its effect on you. Now, these sentences are really long, so I hesitate on continuing to repeat them. I hope you got it. Because there was no period in what I read. It's always the attitude to the event. And it's good to come up with examples. If you have any, that'll be fine. The important thing, though, about the examples that you come up with for yourself later on, perhaps, is that when you do that, if you come up with something and say, but it was a bad thing, my attitude had nothing to do with it. Well, bad has to do with why you labeled it bad in the first place. So I find this easier to understand if you do what I call flipping things over. And it's like when we're looking at a table and we see things on the table, it's like getting down on your hands and knees and looking up from the bottom and seeing things from a completely different perspective. And then seeing if your statement fits. So, for instance, if there's a car accident and somebody gets hurt, is that bad? Well, It depends on how broad the context is that you want to use. I have had accidents that taught me lessons that I needed to learn. And what the guide lectures say over and over and over again is there are no coincidences, there are no accidents. You are only given what you need. Yes, it may hurt. And yes, it may have consequences. And those consequences may be very, very expensive in terms of time and energy and rebuilding or deconstructing something. But from the Patrick's point of view, it wouldn't have happened to you if you didn't need it. So where would the adjective bad fit into something like that? Once you change your attitude towards something, it is astounding how the event itself changes energetically. So I remember one incident where I was being careless in the street and I stepped off a curb and a bus went by me, and the bus was so close and so big, it was like a massive sheet of sheet metal went by my nose. And it dawned on me how close I had come to being flattened. And that shook me up. It was, as far as I was concerned, it was a very close brush with death. And I took an attitude, oh my God, I am so careless, I will get killed. I've got a problem. I'm creating danger for myself. But I work with that. That's what I do in my personal work, is I work with that and say, okay, that's one attitude. How many more are there? It's a game I play. And where I finally got to playing that game, and I play the game with disharmonies. I play the game with things that upset me. It upset me, the idea of dying. I didn't like it. And where I got to on that was that, according to the Pathwork lectures, if I'm supposed to die, they'll kill me. I don't have to worry about it. I don't even have to participate. The meteor will come through the roof and hit only me in the room. If I am supposed to die, if I need to die, if my contract says I'm going to die, I'm going to die. So what's the point of running sheet metal past my nose and scaring me? Well, their point might have been, yes, Jan, you're not watching when you step off curbs, and we'd like you to hang around. So we're going to give you a really good scare. Once I took that attitude that I wasn't in specific danger, but that I'd been given an opportunity to look at my actions, and that the fear had been a way to get my attention, my whole attitude toward that changed. I love telling the story, partly because the bus didn't hit me, and partly because that's what I now believe. So it is a message, and if the message needed to be stronger, I might have gotten hurt. But again, it is my attitude towards that. If my attitude today, since I've worked through that little problem, my attitude today would be, I guess I needed 6 months off sitting in a hospital. Guess I was too active. Guess they needed to slow me down. It's another opportunity to learn the dreadful P word, patience. And with that attitude change, instead of sitting in the hospital with a broken leg, I'm sitting in the penalty box because I wasn't aware and I wasn't using my faculties appropriately. And so they've sat me down and immobilized me, and there's something in that for me. Can you see what the shift of attitude does to the automobile accident? Mm-hmm. So the word bad is a judgment, and that's what was asked before, was when you go at this with judgment, what do you do? Okay, when you go with confrontation and you've already got a judgment in your hand, well, this lecture talks about how you need to, number one, sit down and think about this before you confront. You don't charge off confronting until you know what you're confronting and why. You need to sit down and do some self-work. And as part of the self-work, part of your work is to find the judgment. And when you find the judgment, you need to look at it honestly. Now, there was a phrase at one point in the lectures, because I looked it up on the search engine, and the phrase was scrupulous honesty. And somehow that phrase has disappeared from the lectures because I can't find it. But in this lecture, it uses the phrase scrupulous in something else, but it gets as close as I've ever seen it get before. Okay? But that's what you need. And scrupulous means the equivalent of doing a good scrubbing on yourself. You need to get out the cosmic or emotional nail brush and really clean up your act. You need to find out what you're trying to do, why you're trying to do it, what your biases are, whether you have a secret agenda. Some noises there. So, number one, we've got what we started off on is that it's difficult to do this work because you're messing with your own defensive systems. Okay, that attitude is everything. And now we're moving into okay. Now what do we do with it? So the resistance to facing an unpleasant truth, for whatever reason. Read from the lecture. Resistance to facing an unpleasant truth for whatever reason means I act as though it does not exist, and that will make it go away. And then it says this childish magic does not work and has often the gravest consequences. So your first job is to look at your resistance and try to find out what it could be covering up. Now, in terms of how do you look at your resistance, just looking at a blind spot, very hard to do. And the guide even goes into it, has a paragraph that says, that starts off with, how can resistance be recognized? By a feeling of anxiety when certain questions or points are raised. By impatience, boredom, lack of concentration, the consistent desire to do something else, often less important. By tiredness, the moment the work is approached. And by consistently forgetting. I would bet that everybody recognizes some of these symptoms. So when you do your work, when you say, well, where's my resistance? And you say, I really need something to eat right now. And, I forgot to walk the dog. There's a place where you are going to have to be responsible for realizing at some point that you have just tried to dodge the bullet. That when you tried to look for something, all of a sudden other activities became more important and they seduced you away. And that's our inner work. Nobody but us can know where we are resistant when it gets down to a subtle level.
Jan, can I ask a question about that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because what I recognize is where my resistances are, but I'm wondering if there's some aspect of self-will that I'm not, there's some part in which I'm finding lately it's a bit harder to motivate myself to actually keep on the track. I mean, I have my periods where I'm kind of staying with it and go into action and do what I need to do, but there are other times where it just seems to be I don't have as much self-will or as much current of will to do it like I used to. I don't know why, but so is there some way of grounding or some way of staying present with getting in touch with your will to actually then keep on going?
The guide's primary suggestion for this work is daily review. And I know that's a large topic, which I do intend to go into. And I know that we'd like some variety to those solutions. It's like when people want to lose weight. Diet and exercise. And we get sick of hearing it, but the truth is diet and exercise. That's the only way you're going to change the dynamic, the situation your body's in, is to expend more energy and take less in. That's the system. So where your self-will is concerned, the system is that if your self-will is not present, let me digress for a second, depression is not a lack of energy, okay? depression is recognized across the board by mental health professionals as well as spiritual people. Depression is caused by taking all of your energy and using it to clamp down on something. So you don't have any left over. No. But that's not a lack of energy. That's a misuse of energy. You've got all the energy in the world, and you're using it to hold down something, because depression, especially when it gets serious, is about feeling that something's wrong. But when we think there's going to be an explosion, the primitive reaction is to put as much as possible on top of that explosion to muffle it. And that's what depression is about. We think we're going to fall apart, and so we are going to hold the fort, no matter what. Switching to self-will. I would wonder, if you have all the self-will available in the universe, and it's being used to diffuse the appearance of your will.
Well, I can say from my own experience, it's like I think, well, most of my life I've been super super controlling and very disciplined, like just incredibly disciplined. I never really gave myself much space to be spontaneous and just to kind of go with the flow. And it seems like maybe that's more what's happening now, whereas it's not kind of like an efforted will, which was in the past, maybe me leading to a different type of will, which is more aligned with right action. But I don't feel like there's depression in any of the process in terms of what's going on for me.
Okay, when I do group work like this, especially when I don't know you very well, anything I say is not meant to sound like truth for you.
Okay.
It's just a suggestion.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm not pretending to know the precise answer for you. But I figure if I give you a few examples, you'll be able to figure it out. I heard you say that in the past you have clamped down on your spontaneity.
Yes.
Is that true? Right.
Yes.
I'm going to use just that, even though it does not represent your whole life. Just that as an example. In your system, if you have not allowed yourself freedom, ease, and pleasure, then those areas may have atrophied a bit. In effect, you don't stoke those fires on a regular basis. They tend to go low. They don't go out. You've always got creativity and spontaneity. But they're not going to be readily available and brimming with life and full of ideas. They're going to be a little bit sluggish when you try to activate them. And so the act of self-will is, once again, I'm going to speak in you terms, but please don't take it personally. I'm only trying to talk about the topic. What it sounds like is that your will is having to do everything, and there's no buoyancy due to spontaneity and joy and pleasure. So the image I have in my head is being in water and having to swim to do everything and having no floaty toys, no rubber tires, no, what do they call those things, those tubes that you lay on. They're so cute. Not even a rubber ducky, which are the pleasurable, fun, spontaneous, imaginative things we have in life that make life more fun. And when life is more fun, it doesn't seem like seems like what we're doing is not work. But if it seems like we're doing work all the time, that can be wearying, and the will can become fatigued. So I'm suggesting that that's an idea to look
at. That's very, very closely. Thank you very much for that. That's
definitely no worries.
My neck of the woods.
Okay. my guesses are pretty good. I just need to point out to everybody that they're always guesses. Okay. So, just changing gears here for a second. So, we've looked at the collusion. We've looked at confrontation without judgment, I think, a little bit. And this has led me, actually, into daily reviews. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and go there because it's almost to the hour mark. And I'm just going to sweep through daily review for a moment. And then go back and we'll see where there are questions again. So we've covered a little bit about resistance, a little bit about attitude, a little bit about recognizing attitude. And then the question always comes up a lot, which is, what do I do next? Okay? And what I was starting to say before is, that's like saying, I'm overweight, what do I do? And somebody says, diet and exercise. And you say, I've heard that, I hear that all the time, give me something new. Well, they can color it, they can flavor it, they can put bows on it, but it's diet and exercise. When it comes down to changing your own attitudes, the best way to do it is daily review. I don't know any way to do it except daily review, but you can call it anything you want. And you can do it any way you want. But inevitably, that's what you're going to be doing. So I'll tell you the joke version that that I try to boil it down to make it simple for people to understand. When I would teach classes, I would go to the store, and I would buy the cheapest possible little diary. The little things are no bigger than your hand, and they have all the dates for the year. And I would give them away. They would cost all of $1.15. And I would give them out to the students and say, these are for your daily review. And, of course, their complaint would be, there's no room to write. Good. You're not writing the great novel. What you are writing down in these things is, at some point during the day, morning, noon, evening, all day long, doesn't matter, totally up to you. At some point during the day, use these little books to write down the disharmony, the feelings that came up, and what triggered it. So, dog barked, I hit dog, I felt bad. Doorbell rang, felt anxious, didn't know who it was. Saw something laying on the counter, absolutely freaked out, thought I had forgotten to mail a letter. These are what you write down. And to qualify for making it into the daily review, they should be disharmonies. Put the harmonious stuff in your journal, the one with the flowers and the lace. Okay? This, whatever you use for daily review, the daily review is used for disharmony. Okay? Because we're not trying to fix what's right. We're trying to fix what isn't right, what doesn't go well. Okay? The rest of the time you can go out with your friends and enjoy yourself and talk about your accomplishments. But in your daily review, you're looking at what things that went wrong, and your signal is that you didn't like it, that you would classify it as a disharmony. Now, my list of disharmonies would be radically different from yours because that involves my attitudes and opinions. This is where you can use your attitudes, whether they're right or wrong. You can still use your attitudes because that's your judgment. You have decided what is a disharmony. You may learn over time that it wasn't a disharmony, but you've learned something. And this book is a way of tracking these things. This book is a way of your realizing that day by day you judge certain activities as bad or wrong, and 3 weeks later you've changed your mind. What would that tell you about yourself? For me, it would tell me that that person's got a lousy attitude on a day-to-day basis over things that don't mean much or are actually positive in the long term. And you could use that aha, that realization, and once again, this is an example, to realize that this person is afraid of happiness, that they don't want to be happy, so they immediately judge everything possible as wrong or bad. And then at the end of the week, they're exhausted because they've had a bad week. They know that because they can name the incidents. But if they are allowed to look at it objectively, over time, with some distance, they might be able to see. And then the job is to take what you've learned about your own observations and your own attitudes and your own judgments and begin to apply them in real time. Now, the daily review is peanuts. It's easy compared to trying to do things in real time. And that's where I think the questions normally come up about how do I confront as if you're supposed to bop into confrontation without having done any homework? That's only for the pros. That's only for experts. The rest of us really need to sit down and answer some essay questions for ourselves before we go point fingers at somebody else and say, you are creating a problem. So the first thing you do is look at where am I contributing to the problem, which, by the way, can segue us into collusion. Okay? And that's why collusion is such a large topic, really, in pathwork. So data review is a way of writing down the briefest of information and our reactions to it. And then a week later, 2 weeks later, reviewing this, and what we're looking for is patterns. The pattern can be that every time a short person walks in the room, I get upset, and I like tall people. I don't know what your patterns are, okay? But any pattern you find is useful. And one of the reasons why patterns are really, really useful is because when you fix something and you only fix one thing, that's nice, doesn't give you a great feeling of accomplishment. But if you can find the underlying pattern in a series of disharmonious events or behaviors that leads you to understand a destructive attitude or emotion in your life, and you wind up being able to address that and fix it, it's like pulling a thread and having the entire fabric change. And if you don't have a lot of enthusiasm for this work, you pull off one event like that in your life, and you will find that you suddenly have a lot of enthusiasm for this work, because it makes almost anything seem possible. And my experience is that self-analysis is easier than we give it credit for. It is resistance that tells us it's not. So I'm just pausing for a second to denote the hour, because I'm going to maybe cutting this in half later on. Any questions at this point?